up for this talk, and I found out a lot of super interesting stuff. What I didn't do so much is like prepare notes or think about exactly what I wanted to say and in what order and write down facts. So this is kind of coming, you know, off the top of my head a little bit, so apologies if it gets a little chaotic. But hopefully we'll get to something interesting. So let's maybe start off with a super classical topic, platonic solids. So I brought my own platonic solids. Kind of, I bought these guys when I taught group theory last semester, and something went wrong with the tetrahedron. But very roughly, you probably seen this before, but what's a platonic solid? It's, let me just say, regular polyhedron. Let me just leave it at that. So these are, you can think of, they're built out of polygons, regular polygons. So a polygon is just like a two-dimensional shape, like a triangle, a square, or an octagon or something like that. And regular means they all have the same angle. And I build these guys by placing them together in configurations, and they end up looking like things like this. And there are various rules about how I want these things to be, but it's not going into too much detail. And so there's a classical list. These are classified. Apparently this was written about in Plato, but I think the actual classification was attributed to another mathematician, a contemporary of Plato, but from around 400 BC. There's five things that you can have, five platonic solids, and they're going to be the tetrahedron, cube. So the tetrahedron, if this was the one that didn't work out, because I think I didn't have the correct pieces in my office right now, but you can sort of imagine if I bend it a little bit, it just, all the faces are triangles, there are four of them, there are four vertices, and it looks like that. The cube, I'm sure you're all familiar with. Octahedron, I've got one of those here, there's a little cube inside it. The octahedron is the green shape around the outside, has eight faces. And then getting a little more complicated, a dodecahedron. And an icosahedron. So these are the classical platonic solids. I want to just touch on kind of one aspect of this. I want to relate it to another problem, which seems a little bit different. Let's try and at least understand why there would be only finitely many things like this, or why we could possibly start to write down a list like this. Okay. So given a platonic solid, the first thing I want to do is actually, I don't so much want to think about the solid itself. What I would prefer to do is to put a sphere around it and then project out from the very center onto the sphere to get a tiling of the sphere. So that's going to be, if you imagine, if I had slides, this would be a bit easier. You can imagine the surface of a sphere with dots on it corresponding to these vertices and lines going between them corresponding to the edges. That's what would happen if you just project out. So given a platonic solid, you get a tiling of the sphere. And actually, I'm going to prefer to think about tilings of the sphere rather than photonic sites, and we'll see that we get a couple more, or a bunch more, when we do that. And so I want to assign to this kind of information, the tiling of the sphere, three natural numbers, P, Q, and R. So how am I going to do that? So let me just draw a picture maybe as an example. So here's like a piece of tiling of a sphere. This is supposed to look regular, of course. I don't know. Okay. So it doesn't look very regular, but the information is all there that this is actually supposed to be a picture of what's going on. This one's kind of messed up if I, for an illustration of another point, I put a cube inside this. But I don't want to think about that cube. I just want to think about the dodecahedron, which is the shape on the outside. Here, every vertex here has three edges coming out of it. So that's what's going on here. Every vertex has these three edges coming out of it. And every face has five edges which bound it. So this should be here. That should look like a regular pentagon. Thank you very much. Okay, so what are my three numbers that I'm assigning to this? So one number is... so let Q equal the number of edges touching each vertex, and let R be the number of edges touching each face or bounding each. Two numbers. The third number is usually going to be two, so I'll sort of explain more about that maybe in a second. Let me explain another way to access this information here. So I want to build a little triangle instead of this kind of pattern over here. And the way I'm going to build a triangle is by putting a dot on a vertex, a dot in the middle of an edge, and another dot in the middle of a face. And I build a triangle like this. Okay. Now let's think about what the interior angles of this triangle are going to look like. So, I claim that this guy here, so the number here, the number of edges bounding the face is 5, and so this angle here is going to be, this, I'm going to need 10 of those to get around the whole thing. In radians, then I claim that's 2 pi over 10 or pi over 5. So in general, this is pi over r. Now, this angle here is kind of a similar business. I'm going to need 6 of those to go around a full circle here. So here, that's because there are 3 edges coming out of that face. So this guy is going to be pi over q. And now in this picture, and in the picture of every platonic solid like this, this angle is always going to be 90 degrees, but I'm going to call it pi over p, and then p is going to be 2 in these examples, but I can think of it as something like, I'll comment on how to change that in a second. P is 2, so this is going to be a right angle. Okay, so that's nice. So out of this, out of the information of the platonic solid, I got these three invariants, well, really just B and Q, Q and R, like this. Okay, now, let's imagine, so I told you that this was really all happening on the surface of a sphere. So when I project all this out onto the surface of the sphere, I've got this triangle here lying on the surface of a sphere. And then, so let me maybe call this triangle A, B, C. So triangle A, B, C lies on the sphere. And then there's a rule that you've probably heard about spherical triangles. So, you know, if I look at ordinary triangles on the plane, then the sum of the interior angles is 180 degrees. If I'm looking, this is, you have to imagine this triangle is really living on the surface of a sphere, in which case the sum of the interior angles there is always bigger than 180 degrees. So that's what happens if I draw a triangle on the surface of a sphere. The angles, sum of the interior angles is bigger than pi. So that gives me this inequality that pi over p plus pi over q plus pi over r is bigger than pi. Or in other words, so I can just cancel off the pi's, I get this number, 1 over p plus 1 over q plus 1 over r is bigger than 1. I put that inequality up on the in the title of the talk because I think it kind of this is really the most concrete way of accessing what I'm going to call the ADE correspondence in a second. Are there any questions about what's happened so far? Please stop me if you guys have any questions.
One quick question. So I guess if over here you're assuming that since it's a sphere of a triangle, it has to have a degree greater than 180 degrees, right?
Right.
So then how come around like the corner, the vertex of the B's, for example, you don't have to assume that that's, why are you assuming that that's exactly 360 degrees?
So really I'm imagining the whole thing, the periodic tiling on the surface. Are you asking why this angle?
Like around there, why is that exactly 2 pi? If we're not
So another way of thinking about this, maybe, is that these numbers are really the order of rotational symmetry around the points A, B, and C. So here, I'm imagining this on the surface of my sphere, and I look at the point B, and I think about rotations of the sphere which preserve this configuration of lines. And then Q is the order of rotation. Maybe I don't quite understand the question.
I don't know if it's a valid question or not even, but it's just like if we're assuming that these angles don't have to add up to 180 degrees on a sphere, then why are we still assuming that the angles around a single point?
A full rotation is still a full rotation, however you measure it. 2 pi or 360 degrees. You're asking why if I go all the way around here is that still 360 degrees? Yeah. So those are things that are rotation by an angle is not something you can choose how to define. It's like that's a well-defined quantity. So rotation by 2 pi is just going rotating all the way around and back to itself. Make sense? Let's now maybe just focus our attention for a second on what numbers could possibly solve this inequality. So we can forget about photonic solids for a while and just think about that inequality. Okay. So problem. Find all p, q, and r natural numbers, positive integers, such that 1 over p
plus 1 over q plus 1 over r is bigger than 1.
Okay. Let's just try and do that. So let's just start from like the very beginning. Let's think, first of all, let's just try some random numbers. So for example, I could have p to be 1. So I could take p equals 1. And then 1 over p is 1, and for q and r, I could take any numbers at all, and it'll satisfy this inequality. So let me just write that like this. So q equals anything, and r equals anything. This is one solution over here. Okay. Of course, I could do a similar thing with q equals 1 or r equals 1. But let me not worry about things that look the same after swapping these and q's. Okay, so what's something else I could do? I could take p to be 2, which it usually was in our situations. And I could take then, what other options do we have? I could take q equals 1, but that's sort of subsumed into this example over here. So let me take q equals 2. And then I have a half plus a half is already 1, and so this guy can be anything. Okay. So these here we have sort of two infinite families of solutions going on. Now I claim that there's going to be only 3 more. So let's see if we can figure it out. So once again, let's try and take p equals 2. Now, I don't want to take q equals 2 because I've already done that. Let's try the next best thing, but q equals 3. So then I have a half plus a third. And what's the sort of smallest possible thing I could put here that doesn't give me something I already have? I claim I could put r equals 3 again. And this gives me a third plus a third is more than a half. Okay, let's keep going. Things are on a roll. I could try another one with q equals 3. And then I claim that r, if I put r to be 4, this still works. Namely, a third plus a quarter is still more than a half. Okay, and then one more along these lines. So I claim that up to reordering the renaming the p, q's, and r's, swapping them around, these are the only solutions that you can get to this inequality. These two infinite ones here, and these three these three exceptions. So just sort of as a teaser for what's to come, this is the A, D, and these guys are called so let's just check out what this has got to do with the Platonic solids. So let's see. So I sort of wrote this a little small, so we can write that up here. So tetrahedron. So with the tetrahedron, designed over here. With all of these ones, remember the p was 2, so this is a table. I'm going to tell you what the p's, q's, and r's were. With the tetrahedron, we had, so p was 2. If you like, you could think of that as the number of faces touching each edge, something like that. The q was, this was the number of edges touching each vertex, that was 3, and the r was the number of the number of edges touching each face, and that was also true. So that luckily that appears on our base over there. And we have the cube. So well, the only cube I've got is the tiny one inside here. But we can see that this is 2 again. The number, the Q is this guy, so there are 3 edges coming out of each corner of the cube, and then there are 4 edges on each face. The octahedron is the thing outside this. And you see, in fact, it's kind of illustrated, what's going on is illustrated by the thing that I've got in my hand. It shows the little cube inside the octahedron. And you see that for each face of the octahedron is corresponding a unique vertex of the cube. And for each face of the cube inside is corresponding a unique vertex of the octahedron. So that, in terms of these numbers, is just saying that these guys are swapped. So in terms of solutions to this equations, we kind of group these guys together. And this is the terminology for this, as we said, that these are dual. The tetrahedron, if you think about it, is self-dual. If I do this process where I've got a dot, where I've got a vertex in each face, and a face in each vertex, I just get another tetrahedron. Okay, and then the last ones are dodecahedron and icosahedron, and these are going to give me the other thing. So I think in this order, 2, 3, 5. So the dodecahedron has faces and 5 edges, and there's 3 edges coming out of each vertex, and the icosahedron is backwards. This guy's also dual. So you could ask, what about these guys? How can I think about those? And there is a way, at least, well, there is a way of thinking about this. So here, if I, instead of thinking about platonic solids, I could think about in terms of these tilings of the plane, of the sphere. And we could imagine, for example, imagine a beach ball. Okay, so, you know, like one of those classic beach balls, it has, it's a sphere, and it has a north pole and a south pole, and then I have all these lines coming down from the north pole to the south pole, and each face is sort of colored a different color, like the sort of thing that the seal might bounce up and down in its nose. So that gives me a tiling of the sphere, and it gives me a P, Q, and R, which I claim fits in this family. So that beach ball is called a hosahedron, and it's dual to something called a dihedron. I hope I'm getting this correct, because I just learned these words today. At least this one. Dihedron. So this guy is a beach ball. So let me just try and quickly draw a picture. So the beach ball has 2 vertices, and the Q was supposed to measure the rotational symmetry around a vertex. So that's going to be the number of lines that are coming down in my beach ball. And so that's going to be some big number. So Q is like this star, and then the number of edges touching each face is now just 2. The faces, these are called looms over here, the stripes on the beach ball. And the dihedron is the thing that's drawn with that. That just looks like that's a ball where I have an equator. And on the equator, the vertices are evenly spread around it. And so that has 2 faces that now. Sort of, if I look on the equator, that's a regular n-gon. Okay. So, all right.
So can the hosahedron and dihedron be realized as like regular polyhedra in Euclidean space, or do they have to be on spheres?
No, yeah, that's the difference. These guys kind of have to be on the sphere. You can see that because here, if I look at one of the cells of the hosahedron, it just has two edges. And so in Euclidean space, you can't have like just two edges bounding a face, which are straight lines. Yeah. That's a good question. How else can we access this kind of stuff? So to talk about the next bit, I'm going to need maybe a little bit more technology. So let me think about exactly what I want to say. This can also be thought of in terms of the rotational symmetries of platonic solids. So symmetry. And there's a device in mathematics which is used to measure symmetry. It's called the group. I know at least some of you know about it because some people are in my class, but maybe some other people have taken a similar class, but maybe not everyone knows about this. So let me just state, So let's explain. Let G be the collection of all rotations of free space. This is a bit of an abstraction if you haven't seen this before. I'm thinking of a set now, and the elements of that set are given by particular rotations of space. So a rotation of space is determined by there's an axis and then there's an angle around which I rotate. Okay. So here there's a well-known result which says that fact is that if you compose two rotations around potentially different axes, so first I could take one axis and rotate in that direction, then I take another axis and rotate in that direction by some other angle, then the claim is that the resulting thing is a rotation around a new axis, is another rotation. So if you compose two rotations, you get another rotation. And the fancy word for all this stuff is that the set G is what's called a group. So, which means I have a notion of composition. I can do rotations in one way and then another way, and I get another rotation. So I don't want to dwell on this, but let's say something along these lines. So another way of thinking about this classification over here that we just saw is in terms of finite collections of rotations. So a finite rotation group is a finite subset of G, which, the fancy terminology is closed under composition. So what this means is that if I take two, if I have some, I have some particular collection of rotations which are sort of my favorite ones, and if I do one of those rotations and then I do another one of those rotations, I get another one of my favorite rotations. So what's an example of that kind of thing? If I take one of my platonic solids and I only look at those rotations which send the solid to itself. So for example, I could look at rotations through a vertex by angle 2 pi by 5. It's rotation by a fifth of a circle. That's going to preserve my thing. Or I could look at rotations through a face by angle 2 pi by 3. And that's going to preserve my thing. And you can see that if I do two of those kinds of operations, then it'll also preserve my shape. So that gives me a finite rotation in this sense. So you might ask, what are all the possible finite rotation groups? And it's a theorem. Not really sure who this is first due to, but inside it's just really a rephrasing of this classification of platonic solids. Every finite rotation group is one of the following. It's basically going to be the same list as before. We have two kind of infinite families. So this is given by something called a cyclic group of order n. There's something called the dihedral group of order 2n. So let me explain what these things are. The cyclic group of order n, that's the easiest one to understand. That's if I just fix a particular axis of rotation and look at rotation by an nth of a turn, or look at rotations by multiples of 2 pi by n. That gives me a group. There are n elements of that group. I can either not rotate at all, I can rotate once by that angle, I can rotate twice by that angle, and so on. And I get exactly a finite subcollection of rotations in this way. This next one here, it includes those kinds of rotations, but the thing to keep in mind is that it's the symmetry group of this beach ball shape over here. So that includes the rotations like that, but then I can also rotate the whole thing 180 degrees like that. And that gives me 2 times n possibilities, if you think about it, because I could rotate, I have n of them like this, and I get another n by doing the same rotation there, then doing this. Okay. Then there are 3 more examples, and these are basically the 3 more examples here. So then these groups have names, they're not surprising, they're called the tetrahedral group. This has order 12. Order just means how many guys are in there, how many rotations are in there. There's the octahedral group, which has order 24. Then there's the icosahedral group, which has order 60. You might ask what happened to like the cube group or the dodecahedron group. Well, the explanation of the fact that those guys were dual to each other, the cube and the octahedron, that tells us that the rotations which preserve one of those shapes are going to be exactly the same as the rotations which preserve another.
Is the icosahedron group also A5, if we know?
Yeah, right. So in fact, these if I just consider these groups abstractly, they have different names. So this one is called A4, this one is called S4, and this one is called A5. There's going to be some other things called A4 and A5 a bit later, which appear in a different place on the list, so don't remember that too much. Okay, so any other questions? So that's cool. So this, so we can think of this classification, which really boils down to just understanding these triples of numbers P, Q, and R, such that some of the reciprocals is bigger than one. That's telling us exactly what are the possible rotational kinds of rotational symmetry you can get in three space. That actually turns out to be a useful thing. I mean, for example, I don't know, chemists like to study this. How you make molecules by sticking atoms together with various kinds of bonds, and they have various kinds of symmetries. It's nice to be able to classify those kinds of symmetries. This is one step of that process. I wanted to mention something else, but let me just ask, how long am I supposed to go on for?
Another
15 minutes. Okay, so let me start talking about something that looks quite different. So, okay, so that was all about kind of the geometry of three-dimensional space, what kind of symmetry you can get in three dimensions. But the whole point of this talk was to illustrate how this kind of, this same classification scheme arises in different ways. So let me start to sort of move towards something else. So let me talk a bit about graphs. So here's the kind of the easiest way to, what I'm going to do is now, given any triple of integers p, q, and r like this, I'm going to assign a particular graph to them. So I'll explain what that means. So given natural numbers p, q, and r, assign what's called a graph. So a graph can have lots of different meanings in math, but this particular one is, what I mean by a graph is just a collection of dots, vertices, and for any two vertices, there could be an edge between them. So it's basically going to be a picture like I'm going to draw now. So the graph is called, I'm going to call it T, E, Q, R. And so here's the picture. So it has a dot in the middle, and then there's going to be three strands coming out of there. And a whole bunch of dots in this direction, a whole bunch of dots in this direction, and a whole bunch of dots in this direction. And the number of dots in each strand is going to be basically the P, Q, and R, except I want it to be labeled like this, so there's going to be P minus 1 dots here, Q minus 1 dots here, and R minus 1 dots here. Okay. So given any triple of numbers P, Q, and R, I can build a graph out of it like this. So now there's a sort of, in particular, if P, Q, and R satisfy 1 over P plus 1 over Q plus 1 over R is bigger than 1, then you get the following. So if P, Q, and R satisfy those, then they fall into one of these categories. In fact, I didn't write down the first category over here, which was the case 1 star star. But that makes perfect sense as a graph. There, it's going to be the case that that one of these guys is 1, and so this graph will just really look like a straight line.
So, so it's going to be. So this is the graph where of t one, let's say one n. I think I'm getting this right. N minus two, and this one is known as the graph A n. Okay, and another thing that I could do is I could look at the graphs coming from triples that look like this. In that case, one of my guys is given by two, so there's going to be a length one edge there. Another one will be given by two, so there's a length one edge there. And then there's another long one coming off like this. So this guy is T2, 2. Maybe this is minus 2, I don't know. The number n here is supposed to be the number of dots, so I might have got the n over there wrong, but I think this one is dn. And then you get these three exceptional cases over here, and they look the same like this. So, 1, 2, 3. T233 has a thing with length 1 and two things of length 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So this one is called P6. Then I have the other ones all look similar to 3. Another thing like this. This one's called P7, and then the last one is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. Oops. 8 is called P8. Okay, so if I'd been more prepared and I had taken the time to make slides, I would have just had this picture there, and I wouldn't have bored you with this. Because at this stage, it should be completely unclear. You know, what am I doing? Why am I assigning these graphs to these set of numbers in this way? It seems like a completely random thing. So I want to just sort of try and briefly explain, from a totally different perspective, how these graphs of type A, D, and E, in particular, you know, these particular ones over here, why they're special just from the perspective of graph theory. In fact, they're special from many perspectives. So here's one way of thinking about it. I'm not sure which of these is going to be the most convincing motivation. But so if you've taken some linear algebra, then this will make sense. And if you haven't, if you're not so comfortable with linear algebra, then maybe this will make less sense, and I'll say something else afterwards. But so given a graph, you can get a certain matrix out of it. So this is going to be an n by n matrix where n is equal to the number of vertices. And the entries of this matrix
are either 0 or 1. And so how do I decide whether to put an entry to be 0 or 1 given my graph? Well, the rows and columns of the matrix correspond to vertices, and if two vertices are joined by an edge, I'm going to put a 1 there, and if they're not joined by an edge, or even if they're the same vertex, then I'll put a 0. So entries are either 0 or 1 according to whether there is an edge
between the corresponding vertices.
Okay, so this is known as the adjacency matrix. See that it basically holds all the information about the graph. It's just a way of recording the graph with zeros and ones according to whether there's an edge between things or not. I don't want to keep that picture up. Over here. So one way of thinking about this is that we can look at the eigenvalues of the adjacency. So there's a number which is associated with this. So given a matrix, given a graph, so let me give some of these things names. So given a graph, let me call the graph G again, and then the adjacency matrix is going to be A sub G. So given a graph G, let rho of G denote the this is going to be the largest positive eigenvalue. So note that the graph of G is a symmetric matrix, so it's going to have these real eigenvalues, and in fact there's a whole theory about these kind of matrices with positive integer entries. There's going to be a largest positive eigenvalue of the adjacency matrix AG, and this is known as the spectral radius of G. So you can think of this as some way of measuring how complicated the graph is.
How do you know it's independent of how you choose to label your vertices?
Right. Well, I claim, you know, if you choose a different labeling of vertices, so that'll be a reordering of the rows and columns of your matrix. That'll correspond to just conjugating the matrix by an invertible transformation. So it'll have the same eigenvalues. It's just a change of basis of the underlying vector space. That's a good question. Let me get to the punchline. So claim or theorem. That the only graphs G with spectral radius less than 2. So, maybe I'm not going to have time to explain how to think about this spectral radius thing. It sounds very abstract now, but there's a very concrete way of thinking about it. Maybe I'll say something about it in a second. Are the graphs of type AN DN E6 E7 and E8. So this is just sort of like a completely different problem in which you see the same answer. You see the same classification scheme as classified platonic solids or the finite rotation groups. Undecided about what to say next, so maybe. Try and explain how to think about this. Or I could just mention. Let me just finish up by mentioning like a few other things, a few other places in which this kind of classification appears, and then I'll leave it for you guys to do some homework to understand where some of that is coming from. I can also give some references after the talk. So, in fact, this classification scheme appears in lots of places. So, here are just a few examples. So the main sort of when the sort of first thing that pops into a lot of people's minds when you talk about things of type A, D, and E are the so-called simple Lie algebras or simple Lie groups. So let me just say briefly what this is about. So we talked about the notion of the group of rotations of free space. Now. More generally, you can talk about the notion of continuous symmetries of spaces of arbitrarily high dimension. If you've taken a group theory class, like for me last semester, then you saw the word simple there. It sort of means that it's kind of indivisible in some sense, as small as it can possibly get. And it turns out that certain simple Lie groups fall into the same kind of categories, and you can associate graphs to them in the same kind of way. And actually, these are only some subset of them over here, but there's a way of understanding in what sense they're distinguished. So let me just say continuous symmetry. There's lots of other things that these classify. There's something called the simple singularities. So a singularity is where when I have a function, so of a bunch of variables. Let's just say three variables for now. Looks something like this, maybe. Let me not try and explain exactly what a simple singularity is, because you know, it's going to run. But it's just another seemingly totally unrelated place in mathematics where this classification occurs. There's a few more examples, but I think they get sort of they get a little more technical and require a bit more background. So maybe let me just leave it at that. And please, you're welcome to ask questions about any of the examples. Okay, so I'll leave it there.
Thank you.
picture, I'm really just thinking about the graphs just as graphs. Angles do play a role in this theory, but they're not these angles over here. They do appear, but there's another. In fact, one of the things over here that I didn't mention, there's another way, a totally different way of assigning a finite group to a graph like this, which is instead of building a group out of rotations, I can build a group out of reflections. And so each of these dots is going to correspond to a reflection about a fixed hyperplane. And if the two dots don't have an edge between them, then the hyperplanes are orthogonal to each other, so reflections will commute. But if the dots share an edge, then I want to put the hyperplanes at like a 60 degree angle. And you can build a group in that way, which is generated by reflections across hyperplanes in that way, in some higher dimensional space. And then I claim, once again, the group is going to be a finite group. It'll sort of close up and have only finitely many such reflections, if and only if I do it for one of these diagrams that I have at the beginning. So that's a place where sort of angles appear.
So the Biela groups corresponding to these Dynkin diagrams the same as the finite reflection groups appearing in the classification of finite reflection groups?
So the Biela groups are the finite reflection groups, but they're not the finite rotation groups. Right, so yeah, so apologies if this is a little more technical, but that's kind of a part of the interest of this topic, is that there's two completely different families of finite groups appearing in this story. One is these finite rotation groups, which describe the symmetries of these Platonic solids, and the other are these Biela groups, which really describe symmetries of some higher dimensional spaces. Here, the first one was rotations in three dimensions. Here, these are rotations in reflections in n dimensions, where n is the rank of the graph. So yeah, that's kind of part of why this whole thing is so clear.
So also, when you wrote down the classification of finite reflection groups, I don't think there was anything for type A.
Yeah, there's a good. The type A ones were the cyclic groups in the rotation, in that sense. So, you know, the cyclic groups, the dihedral groups, and then the three exceptional groups were there. So I think you're getting. You want to think of the Biela groups, but these are not the Biela groups of the corresponding.
Oh no, I guess I must have interpreted something wrong. I guess it did appear. I guess I thought.
I think the thing that doesn't appear in this case, or the thing that's harder to think about, is that there was no Platonic solid corresponding to this case. Over here. Here, at least, in type D, it wasn't really a Platonic solid, but we had this beachball thing and the dihedron. Here, it's sort of, you have to think of something like it has only one face, but n number of sides or something like that. It's just like a n-gon where I'm not allowed to flip it upside down. So this one you can't really picture as a platonic solid. That's what makes it weird.
Yep. Can you describe the concrete, like, sort of explanation of the spectral radius?
Sure. Just briefly, probably easier on this graph over here. The kind of thing that I want to. So what would it mean to have an eigenvalue for? What would it mean to have an eigenvalue for this matrix, for the adjacency matrix? Roughly speaking, so an eigenvalue, what would it mean? What would an eigenvector be? A vector basically means an assignment of a number to each vertex. right? Because that would be describe me a vector. Those would be the coordinates of my vector in space, and that would be something that I could apply my matrix to. So for example, here's just some random minima 1, 5, 7, 9, 2, 4, 1. Those numbers are chosen arbitrarily. Something like this. This is called a labeling of the graph. So this you can think of as a vector, and you can ask the question, when is such a vector going to be an eigenvector for the adjacency operator? And the answer is, if you sort of think through how the adjacency matrix works, here's my vector, and if I look at the sum of the numbers on all the edges which are adjacent to that vector, then that I want that to be some fixed multiple of the number on the edge. That's what an eigenvector is for the adjacency operator. Now there's this whole theory so it's kind of hard to see it's kind of hard to find eigenvectors in this way. But there's a theory there's something called the Perron-Frobenius theorem, which sort of describes various ways to simplify this process. Actually, what ends up happening is that what you're looking for is a way of assigning numbers to each of the edges, such that when I sum the values around the edges, I get less than or equal to twice the number in the middle. So that 2 there, that twice, is coming from, these are the things with spectral radius less than 2. And there's a way of labeling these triangle graphs in a particular way, which is, let me just do a sort of bigger example. Here I've always got 1. Here there's 3 things going on, so here I've got 2/3, 1/3, 4, 2, 3/4, 2/4, 1/4, 1, 2/3, 1/3, 2/3, 1/3. So this won't exactly be an eigenvector, but it'll become somehow close to an eigenvector. And the claim is that this will satisfy the condition that the sum around the edges of each vertex is less than or equal to twice the thing in the middle, if and only if this is a triangle graph with a P, Q, and R, such that 1 over P plus 1 over Q plus 1 over R is bigger than 1. So that's kind of where it's coming from. It's to do with these labelings of this graph, such that the sum around the edges of the labels is not too big compared to the thing in the middle. There's another much deeper explanation of where labelings on these kinds of graphs come from that comes out of the finite rotation group picture. But that's